This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women. They might be right next door, right down the street, around the corner, but they have some stories, the things that they've done for the sake of our freedom. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a whole lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And today I'm in Visalia, California, where coming up on August 15th, they'll mark the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II with a special Spirit of 45 celebration. I'll have the privilege of speaking there. And if you're in the area, I'd love to see you there. And maybe you'll run into our guest today, who has been in Visalia for nearly four decades now. In fact, for 17 years, he was involved with the Visalia Police Department, started volunteering there later in life. But we're going to go way back to his early days outside of Detroit in Warren, Michigan. Marvin Shields, 94 years old, our guest today. Are you really 94? You don't seem like you're 94.
I don't look it either.
No, I bet you don't act it.
Well, I am.
I'll have to ask the fine folks here at Walnut Park in Visalia, where Marvin has his Navy insignia all over the place, and a Navy career that I'm sure was not what you were thinking about when you were a young boy growing up outside of Detroit, one of seven children. Do you remember what that was like? Because most of the people listening weren't alive for the Great Depression, but well, you experienced it there in Michigan.
When I'm about two, I was always in a sailor suit.
Really?
Yeah.
Where'd that come from? Was your father in the Navy or something?
No, he was in the Army.
Yeah?
World War One.
Uh-huh. But you, for some reason, you're in a sailor suit. Was it because of the Great Lakes nearby? Or?
No. Just my mother bought me my first sailor suit and then everything. I always wanted to be in the police department, fire department, and some jobs like that through my whole life, and I completed them too.
I guess you did, yeah. You're a firefighter in Detroit and on a police force here.
And then I was in a juvenile hall here, and I say I worked there for 3 or 4 years, and I just kept busy all my life.
You've worn a lot of hats, not just that sailor hat. You mentioned your father in the Army in World War One. How much do you know about what he did during that war?
He never talked about it, but in the other room I have a picture of him in his Army uniform, and he got discharged for flat feet. He got a medical discharge.
Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe you wouldn't have been born otherwise.
Yeah, probably.
So you're born almost a New Year's baby. The very end of 1920 is when you came into this world. But those growing up years, those times that were so tough for our country in the early 1930s especially, how did you experience that there in Michigan?
Well, the Depression was about that time too.
That's what I mean. Yeah. What was that like? Can you give us a taste of what life was like then?
We lost our house in Detroit. And then traded a house out in the country for a good house in Detroit. That's the only way we survived. And I just went to pick up places to pick up fish and peanut butter and apple butter and stuff like that. But when we made a sandwich, we made it with lard, and then salt and pepper, and then closed the sandwich and we ate. That's how we ate then days.
That's all you had?
Yeah.
A little lard, a little salt, a little pepper. No meat, no produce, none of that.
Well, we had to eat and survive the way, but I went into the CC camps in my 12th grade. I never graduated then.
Mm. And was that because you needed to make money for the family?
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I was the first boy to go to the CC camps. We made $30 a month. We had to send 22 home. And the $8 for expenses and stuff I needed at camp. But then my brother Norman behind me, he went to another camp. And then my brother, Frank Jr., he went to another camp. So that was $66 my mother got to save our house.
Wow. That puts things in perspective. So many people today have no idea what life was like back. And most of the people listening were not born while all this was going on. And so the Civilian Conservation Corps, they had these camps, and there would be different jobs that you could do. All the stories I've heard, it's pretty intensive labor. What was the kind of stuff that you were doing?
When I was 16, I was driving a dump truck. Yeah, I'm building roads and stuff like that. But that's when I was 16. And then the weather didn't bother me at all. I just wore a sweater with a V-neck and a wool sweater on, and off I went.
Snow or otherwise?
Yeah, it's up in Whitefish Point up in there, yeah.
Woo!
Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan.
Yeah, that's pretty far north. One question I like to ask every veteran, because every veteran seems to have a pretty clear recollection of it. December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you heard?
Yes. We were sitting around the table. My father, two of my buddies, and myself playing pinochle when it came over the radio. So we all stood up, couldn't figure what the heck was going on. But then when I went down to the federal building in Detroit the next day, and I wasn't quite 21. I had a draft number, and I wasn't going to use that in the Army or Marines or anything. So I went down and volunteered for the Navy.
What was it that compelled you to do that? What made you want to go be a part of this?
Well, they were getting pretty close to us. I mean, the Japs were between Pearl Harbor and us.
Mm-hmm. Here, your father had fought what they called the war to end all wars, and now here's his son getting into another war just 20 years later.
Yeah.
Do you remember what you expected out of the Navy, what you thought it was going to be like?
I thought it was just going to be, we got to hold them back. We weren't going to land on our shores and be any part of us.
So you were pretty motivated by what had happened at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, but then, see, 20 days later, after my mother got me back out of the Navy, I went the next day after the 29th of December. I was 21. At that time, they were taking rated people, like truck drivers, machinists, Air Corps people. They were just starting with 38 down.
Mm-hmm.
So my uncle went. He was 38 then, and he was over in Midway. But then I went through in a rated company because I'd done paramedic work and I was with fire department. That's why I went through so fast. And in 2 months, I was through boot camp and everything with the rated company and out to the Mount Vernon. You know that ship?
That's the troop ship, right?
Yeah.
How was it that you ended up on the USS Pensacola?
They got torpedoed and they went into got partial repair.
Right. So the Pensacola was hit. This is off of Guadalcanal.
Yes.
They call it the Battle of Tassafaronga.
Yeah.
So it was one of the American ships that took heavy damage there, was repaired at Tulagi.
Yeah, that's Tulagi.
And ended up by January of 43 at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Is that where you got aboard?
Yeah, because I was already assigned to that ship before she got hit.
So you knew you were going to be on the Pensacola, but you weren't on her yet.
Oh, no.
And then you find out she just got torpedoed.
Yeah, but then they put me aboard the troop ship going to Australia.
Uh-huh.
And New Zealand. And so for about 6-7 months, I just worked on that troop ship.
The Mount Vernon.
Yeah, and we always travel alone across the ocean because we were faster than the battle wagons and aircraft carriers. So we had to change course every 7 minutes out there.
You're zigzagging to miss the subs. Well, let's talk about the Pensacola. You were on the Pensacola for the Battle of Midway?
Yep. Tuawa, Gilbert's, the Sullivan Islands, and right on through all of them.
Yeah. Iwo Jima?
Oh, yeah. We got hit there, too. I was in the fire room then. See, if I wasn't in the fire room, I'd have been on a 5-inch gun.
What do you remember about Midway? What were you doing? You were on that 5-inch gun crew then?
If I wasn't on duty. See, we were on 4-on and 4-off, 4-on and 4-off. All around the clock, 7 days a week.
So what was your duty?
Well, I started out as a water tender for third class.
Uh-huh.
Then I went to second class and first class. When the war ended, everything stopped for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a hospital in Vallejo, California. Malaria, different things, skin cancer.
Mare Island. My show last week was with a lady who was a nurse at Mare Island Naval Hospital.
My wife was too.
Really? So that's how you met your wife in the hospital?
Yeah.
So you talked about starting out water tender, third class and all that. For the people that don't have any Navy experience, can you explain to everybody what that means?
Well, it's a boiler room on the Pensacola. There's four boiler rooms forward and four after, an engine room between them, and we had to keep the fires in the boilers that form steam for the ship to go ahead.
Then general quarters sounds, and what happens?
If you're locked in a position where you're on duty,
mm-hmm.
You got to stay there over like maybe 6 hours instead of 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'd be on the guns the other time.
And the gun that you would go to was a 5-inch gun?
5-inch gun.
That's a big gun.
Yeah.
That's a loud gun. And what would you do on that gun crew?
Be a pointer. Pointer and a trainer.
One is vertical, one's horizontal?
Yeah, up and down, yeah, across.
So your job is to get the elevation of the gun right?
Or the aircraft or we're shooting at.
Mm-hmm.
Or the shoreline, whatever we're shooting on.
And you're working in unison with how many other guys on that gun crew?
We had people lifting shells up to us, you know, from the holes. Rammer would ram the shell in and then bag powder behind it. And about six or seven on the floor deck, yeah.
Do you remember the first time that you had to go man that gun when this was really happening and you were in the thick of it?
We practiced almost every day.
Practice?
Yeah.
But what about the first time it wasn't practice and it was for real? Was that at Midway?
Yeah.
The Battle of Midway is a huge, huge moment in World War II. Big turning point.
Yeah.
You were part of it.
Yeah.
There aren't very many guys around anymore that were part of it. What can you tell us, those who weren't there, about what you saw there, the kinds of things, the scope of it, what you experienced?
We had to stay out on a ship. We never got ashore.
But that's where all the fighting was, on the ships.
Yeah.
There's planes in the sky, right?
Yeah, they went right and our plane's right behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a stack here and a stack there just flying right through our, and we shot maybe a couple of our own planes down too.
Yeah, this is a chaotic scene.
Yeah.
You've got all these American ships, all these Japanese ships, all these airplanes in the sky, all these guns going off, bombs being dropped.
You couldn't see through the ack-ack that was up in the sky when them planes went through them and, mm-hmm. or when they come in.
Just clouds of black from all the anti-aircraft artillery.
Yeah, it looked like a polka dot.
Uh-huh.
Polka dot sky.
And you're on the 5-inch gun?
Yeah.
Trying to shoot at some of those planes?
Yep. Or? So, you know, I never actually shot anybody there. I don't know how many shells that we fired may have killed somebody. So I can't say whether I did or didn't kill anybody.
But what was that like? I mean, you're just a 21-year-old kid. Was that scary?
Everything's scary. I mean, even Chihuahua was one of the worst battles we had. I had a couple people from me when I was in a CC camp from Detroit. We fished them out of the water.
At Tarawa? I want to get to that. Let's finish up Midway just because of how pivotal it was and so we can understand the Pensacola's role here. Because one of the reasons that battle was so successful is the Japanese carriers that the American forces sunk. But the Japanese also sank an American carrier, the Yorktown.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, the job of your ship was to help protect those American carriers, right?
Oh, yeah. There were no battle wagons around then.
Right. So you guys were heavy, the biggest thing going to defend them.
Heavy cruisers, yeah. Then the light cruisers behind us.
So it's not like you were on the perimeter out of the action. You guys were right in the middle of all the action.
We never noticed it then. Fire every day.
I'm just trying to imagine what that must have felt like for you. 21 years old, out here in the middle of the ocean.
I would tell you that the CC camps, when I had to leave in the 12th grade to save our home.
That prepared you?
Yeah, I turned into a man then. I was a boy playing football and baseball for school and that. And, but that CC camps made a man out of me. And I wasn't scared of anything then. I drove a dump truck for gravel and that, making roads and pulling logs out of the woods and that. Yeah, it made a man out of me then.
And you're still going strong at 94. It's pretty eye-opening, isn't it? If you're like me and you weren't born yet, you didn't live through the Great Depression, you didn't experience anything like the CCC camps Mr. Shields was talking about, that Civilian Conservation Corps was part of FDR's New Deal. Mr. Shields entered the program so his family could save its home. And hearing him share that memory of it makes me wonder how many others were in the CCC for similar reasons. How much the experience men had in those difficult situations prepared them for what they'd be facing in a worldwide war. 300,000 was the most that were in the CCC program at any one time. But over the 9 years that the program operated until it was disbanded in June of 1942, more than 9 million young men participated. 16 million Americans would end up serving in uniform in World War II, and for Sailor Marvin Shields, that meant an up-close view of some of the Pacific's most crucial battles aboard the heavy cruiser USS Pensacola. Check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. If you live anywhere near Visalia, California, plan on meeting Mr. Shields on Saturday, August 15th at an event commemorating the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. just trying to keep that spirit of 45 alive. I'll tell you more about that effort, and we'll get the rest of Marvin Shields' story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.